Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today we're embarking on a journey looking into one of the ancient Near East's most fascinating and sometimes, well, elusive civilizations, the Hurrians. We've got a lot of material here on their history, their language, their culture. Our task is to sort of distill the clearest picture we can of these people. They were a real force in the Bronze Age.
Definitely. We're talking roughly 3rd to late 2nd millennium BCE, and their influence stretched, you know, across northern Syria, upper Mesopotamia, southeastern Anatolia, a huge area.
But there's this challenge, isn't there? The scholars call it the Hurrian problem.
Right.
Because despite how widespread they were, their own voice, their own records, they're often quite faint. We end up learning about them mostly through what others wrote, like the Hittites or Egyptians.
Exactly. And that's key. It's not like we're talking about one single unified empire here. It's more about a people defined by this really unique language and a cultural influence that was just pervasive. It really shaped their more famous neighbors.
So it's like putting together a mosaic from scattered pieces.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah, picking up fragments from all over.
So how do we even start to understand a people like that? History's rich, but it's tricky to reconstruct. We'll explore their origins, which are really debated their unique language, the rise and fall of Mitanni, their most powerful kingdom, and their incredible impact. Let's start right there. Who were the Hurrians? Where did they actually come from? There's some intense scholarly debate here, as you mentioned.
Oh, absolutely. The traditional view for a long time was that they migrated probably from a northern homeland, maybe the Caucasus, maybe eastern Anatolia. This idea was partly based on the linguistic links to the later Urartian language, you know, spoken up around Lake Van.
And certain archaeological cultures, too.
Right, like the Kura Araxes culture, known for its distinct pottery and metalwork. People tried to link that movement to the Hurrians showing up in texts later.
But there's this other idea, a really compelling one, that they might have been there much, much earlier, an indigenous presence.
Yes, exactly. And a strong argument for this comes from linguistics. There's a Sumerian word for coppersmith, tabira or tabira. Some scholars make a good case that this is actually a Hurrian loanword borrowed way back in the 4th millennium BCE.
Fourth millennium, so the very dawn of urban civilization.
Potentially, yes. If that's right, it completely flips the script. It means Hurrian speakers were in Mesopotamia right from the early stages. Their homeland wasn't somewhere else they came from, but maybe right there in that fertile arc they historically occupied.
Which would help explain why they seem archaeologically invisible before the mid-second millennium. They weren't newcomers. They just used the same stuff as their neighbors.
Precisely. They largely adopted the material culture around them. So for centuries, maybe millennia, their unique language becomes the most consistent marker we have. It's the thread running through it all.
And adding to the confusion, they were called different things in different texts.
An embarrassment of designations, I've heard it called. Yeah, that's a good term for it. They called themselves Eri. The Egyptians called them Yor. And then you have terms like Subartu and the biblical Horites.
How do those fit in? Is Subartu Hurrian?
Well, the consensus now is that Subartu was more of a geographical term for northern Mesopotamia, not necessarily an ethnic one, though Hurrians certainly lived there. The identification of the biblical Horites with the Hurrians, though, that's pretty widely accepted now.
Okay. And that corrects older ideas about Horites being cave dwellers.
Right. Those were inaccurate translations. We now understand the Horites, likely Hurrians, as an advanced people, especially known for metallurgy.
Okay, let's focus on that language then. You said it's unique. What makes it so different?
Well, first off, it's considered a linguistic isolate. It's not Semitic. It's not Indo-European. The only language it's clearly related to is Urartian, forming the Hurro-Urartian family.
An isolate? Wow. And structurally?
Mm-hmm.
Typologically.
Two main things stand out. First, it's agglutinative.
Agglutinative.
Yeah, it means you build words by sticking together distinct little parts, like morphemes, each carrying a specific bit of meaning. So you might have a root word, like atai for father, and you add a suffix, say rudi, to make a tardi, which means ancestor. You just keep adding pieces.
Like building with Legos, adding specific blocks of meaning.
Exactly like that. It's very systematic. The other really significant feature is its case system. Hurrian uses an ergative absolutive system.
Okay, ergative absolutive. That sounds different from languages like English or Latin.
It is fundamentally different. In English, the subject of a sentence is usually marked the same way. Whether it's I run or I throw the ball, I is the subject. But in an ergative language, how you mark the doer of an action changes. It depends on whether the verb has a direct object or not. So the subject of I run might be marked differently than the subject of I throw the ball.
So the grammar itself reflects a different way of viewing actions and participants.
In a sense, yes. It's a different grammatical logic. And it's pretty rare among the major ancient Near Eastern languages. Interestingly, Sumerian also had an ergative system.
Fascinating. So how on earth did scholars figure this out? Deciphering a lost, isolated language sounds like a monumental task.
It absolutely was, and it happened in stages. Early on, a lot depended on one very long letter. It was from the Mitanni king, Tushratta, written to Pharaoh Amenhotep III, found in the Amarna archives in Egypt.
Just one letter.
Well, that was the main substantial text for a long time. Then came helpful bits from places like Ugarit polyglot lexical lists, basically ancient dictionaries, that gave word equivalents. And Ugarit used an alphabetic cuneiform, which gave a clearer picture of Hurrian sounds than the Mesopotamian syllabic system.
But the really big break came later.
Yes, the game changer was in 1983. At Hattusa, the Hittite capital, archaeologists found a major Hurrian-Hittite bilingual text, the Song of Release.
A bilingual, like a Rosetta Stone for Hurrian.
Pretty much. It gave this long Hurrian narrative with a parallel Hittite translation right alongside it. That allowed for this incredible leap in understanding Hurrian grammar, syntax, vocabulary, just massive.
Now, speaking of complexities, we have to address this long-standing puzzle.
Yeah.
The so-called Indo-Aryan question. Related to Mitanni, their most powerful kingdom. This gets really interesting.
It does, and it fueled debate for, well, over a century. There were these specific pieces of evidence that seemed out of place. You had Indo-Aryan throne names for some Mitanni kings, like Artatama, Shatarna, Tushratta.
Right.
Then there was a treaty between Mitanni and the Hittites that invoked four gods, Mitra, Varuna, Indra, and the Ashvins. These are clearly Vedic deities from the Indian subcontinent.
Vedic gods in Syria. How did that happen?
That was the question. Plus, there was this famous horse training manual written by a guy named Kekuli, apparently a Hurrian from Mitanni, but it contained specific technical terms for horse training that were Indo-Aryan, like Ika Wartana for one turn.
And the chariot warriors.
Yes. The elite chariot warrior class known as Marianu. That word itself seems to be a Hurrianized version of the Indo-Aryan word Maria, meaning young warrior.
So with all that, the early 20th century scholars cooked up this Aryan invasion hypothesis.
Pretty much. The idea was that a small but powerful group of Indo-Aryan warriors, maybe migrating from somewhere near Iran or Central Asia, swept into Hurrian territory. They proposed these warriors impose themselves as a ruling class, bringing with them this advanced military technology, the light spoked wheel war chariot, which gave them dominance.
But that neat picture has kind of fallen apart, hasn't it?
It largely has, yes. A modern reevaluation looks at the evidence more critically. For one thing, that Indo-Aryan linguistic footprint, it's actually remarkably small. It's mostly confined to those royal names and some technical terms. It didn't permeate the whole language or administration.
And the gods.
Those four Vedic gods, they appear in that one treaty, just once. Alongside dozens and dozens of native Hurrian, Syrian, and Mesopotamian deities who were clearly more central to Mitanni religion. Plus, many of those kings with Indo-Aryan throne names, we know they often had regular Hurrian names before they became king, suggesting the Indo-Aryan name was maybe a prestigious adoption upon taking the throne.
And the Marianu warriors weren't purely Indo-Aryan either.
No, evidence suggests the Marianu class, while maybe taking its name from an Indo-Aryan root, was actually multi-ethnic. It included Hurrians and others. And maybe most importantly, the archaeology.
What about it?
The archaeology now shows pretty clearly that the light spoked wheel war chariot was developed and used in the Near East before any supposed Indo-Aryan elements appear in Mitanni. Mitanni certainly perfected its use and organization, but they didn't introduce the fundamental technology.
So persistence of this Aryan hypothesis for so long, it feels like it tells us more about the history of scholarship, maybe about past academic biases or preoccupations with racial theories than it does about the Hurrians themselves.
I think that's a very fair assessment. It absolutely reflects earlier scholarly trends. The consensus today is quite different. We now see the Indo-Aryan component not as the foundation of the Mitanni kingdom, but as a relatively small, possibly elite cultural import. Think of it like using French terms in diplomacy or Latin in science in later periods. It was likely adopted by a fundamentally Hurrian dynasty for prestige, reflecting the complex cultural borrowing that happened among late Bronze Age elites.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roge Bosch Hannah. Ah, perfect timing. Nothing like a warm cup of chai during a really captivating discussion, right?
Indeed. Let's see. Sips. This one's got a lovely balance today. Not too bitter, just enough sugar, I think.
Agreed. Sure, yeah. That's perfect for refueling before we dive back into the political roller coaster of the ancient Near East.
Absolutely. A moment to pause before we tackle the rise and fall of empires.
Okay, let's pick up the story then. Earliest documented hurry in history. We're looking at the city-state of Urkesh, right? Modern Telmozan, late 3rd millennium BCE.
That's right. Urkesh is key. It seems to be the first known Hurrian kingdom we have clear evidence for, and it was a major religious center for them.
And this is where we find that distinctive Hurrian royal title.
Yes, Endon. That appears at Urkesh. And we also have the earliest known coherent text in the Hurrian language from there. A foundation inscription, like for a temple, by a king named Tishital, dated around 2010 BCE.
And Urkesh wasn't just some minor player. They dealt with the big powers.
Oh, yes. During the Akkadian Empire's peak, under Norm Sin, Urkesh was important enough that one of its kings, Tupkish, actually married a daughter of Norm Sin, a princess named Ukwutum. That shows Urkesh was a significant kingdom, a serious player in its own right.
Okay, fast forward then to the mid-second millennium BCE, the rise of Mitanni. You called it the zenith of Hurrian power. How did this kingdom emerge?
Mitanni seems to emerge around 1550 BCE, maybe a bit earlier, in the Khabur River Valley, that triangle area in northeastern Syria. It looks like it coalesced partly because of power vacuums left by the collapse of other kingdoms, like Babylon and the old Assyrian trading network.
And was it a centralized empire like Egypt or the Hittites?
Probably not quite as centralized. It seems to have been more of a powerful confederation. There was a core Hurrian dynasty ruling from their capital, Washukani, which... frustratingly, we still haven't found
it. Still haven't found it. Wow.
Nope. It's one of the great archaeological mysteries. But from Washkani, this dynasty held sway over a network of vassal kings. People like Idrimi of Alalak, whose statue inscription famously details how he swore allegiance to the Mitanni king Peritarna.
So Mitanni becomes a major force. How big did its influence get?
Under kings like Sushtar, around 1425 BCE, Mitanni reached its peak. Its influence stretched from the Mediterranean coast in the west, maybe near Aleppo, all the way east, across northern Mesopotamia, maybe even influencing parts of Assyria for a time. It was definitely a member of the Great Powers Club of the Late Bronze Age.
And we can track this influence archaeologically.
Yes, one key marker is that distinctive pottery we mentioned earlier, Nuzi ware. Its distribution helps show the extent of Mitannian cultural and likely political reach.
Okay, so Mitanni is playing in the big leagues. What were its relationships like with the other superpowers? Egypt, the Hittites, Assyria.
Very complex and dynamic. With Egypt, there was initial hostility. Pharaohs like Thutmose III campaigned against Mitanni in Syria. But eventually, it evolved into a stable alliance.
An alliance? How?
Cemented by royal marriages. We see this clearly in the Amarna letters. Mitanni kings like Artakama I, Shatarna II, and Tushratus sent their daughters and sisters, princesses like Juluhepa and Taduhepa, to marry Egyptian pharaohs. It was high-level diplomacy, though the letters often show the Mitanni kings asking, sometimes begging, for Egyptian gold in return.
Interesting dynamic. What about the Hittites? Less friendly.
Much less friendly. There was deep-seated antagonism there, constant rivals for control over Syria. This culminated in the devastating campaigns of the Hittite king, Sepaluliumassert, around 1344 to 1322 BCE.
What happened?
Sepaluliuma was brilliant and ruthless. He exploited internal chaos in Mitanni. King Tushratta was assassinated in a palace coup. Sepaluliuma used that turmoil to peel off Mitanni's western vassals in Syria, defeated the Mitannian army, and even sacked the capital, Washukani.
A decisive blow. And Assyria. You said there was a reversal there.
A dramatic one. Early on, Mitanni had actually dominated Assyria, treating it as a vassal state. But as Mitanni weakened due to Hittite pressure and internal strife, Assyria saw its chance. Kings like Ashur-uballit I, around 1354 BCE, asserted Assyrian independence. They started chipping away at Mitannian territory from the east, effectively helping to dismember the Mitanni Empire.
So it sounds like Mitanni's collapse in the mid-14th century BCE was quite swift, caught between the Hittites and the resurgent Assyrians, plus internal problems.
Exactly. It was a perfect storm. Internal civil war after Tushratta's death, combined with overwhelming external pressure from both west and east, Mitanni basically disintegrated.
Did it vanish completely?
Not immediately. It survived for a while as a smaller rump state, often called Hanagadbat, mostly under Hittite control or influence. But its independence was gone. The final nail in the coffin came when the Assyrian king Adad-nirari I conquered what was left, around 1295 BCE.
So politically, Mitanni was wiped off the map. but you said the Hurrian people and culture persisted.
They did. The political structures vanished, but the population didn't just disappear overnight. Hurrian communities continued to exist, gradually assimilating into the rising powers like Assyria and later Urartu. Some scholars even suggest that the kingdom of Shubria, known from Leo-Assyrian texts in the 7th century BCE, might have been kind of last pocket, a final remnant of Hurrian civilization.
Okay, let's shift focus now from the big political picture to the internal world of the Hurrians. Their society, their beliefs, their culture. What was life like?
Well, based on texts, especially from places like Nuzi, we see a hierarchical society. You had the king, the Endan, at the top.
Right.
Then a powerful class of nobles and landowners, and then that elite chariot warrior class, the Merianu. They seem to have been a key part of the social upper crust, probably rewarded with land grants and heavily involved in horse breeding and training, which was crucial for their military power.
And you mentioned Nuzi providing incredible detail about daily life, not just royal stuff.
Exactly. The thousands of tablets found at Nuzi, which was more like a provincial administrative center, are mostly private documents. We're talking marriage contracts, wills, adoption papers, land sales, lawsuits. It's an unparalleled window into the day-to-day legal and economic life of a Hurrian-dominated society.
And this is where those fascinating parallels with the Hebrew Bible, specifically the patriarchal narratives in Genesis, come in.
Precisely. The Nuzi texts illuminate social customs that seem remarkably similar to stories about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It's quite striking.
Can you give some examples?
Sure. One common practice in Nuzi was for childless couples to formally adopt an heir, sometimes even a trusted servant, to inherit their property and perform funerary rites. This sounds very much like Abraham's lament about his servant Eliezer being his heir before Isaac was born.
Okay.
Another one. Nuzi marriage contracts often stipulated that if a wife was barren, she was obligated to provide her husband with a handmaiden to bear children. This mirrors the story of Sarah giving Hagar to Abraham.
Wow.
There's also the practice of sistership contracts. A man could legally adopt his wife as his sister, which seems to have granted her enhanced social status and legal rights. This provides a potential cultural background for those strange episodes where Abraham and Isaac pass off their wives as their sisters in foreign lands. It might have been about invoking a higher legal status for protection.
And the household gods. Rachel stealing Laban's teraphim.
Yes. The Nuzi texts show that possession of the family's household gods, the teraphim, often served as the legal proof of rightful inheritance, almost like a title deed to the family property. So Rachel stealing them wasn't just about religious sentiment, it was a legal move to secure Jacob's claim to Laban's inheritance.
That adds a whole new layer to those stories. Let's turn to their religion. Complex. Syncretic.
Very much so. The Hurrian pantheon was huge and quite flexible. They readily absorbed deities from neighboring cultures, Mesopotamia, Syria, Anatolia, integrating them into their own system.
Who are the main players, the big gods?
The top tier usually included Peshub, the great storm god, king of the gods, often depicted with a lightning bolt and an axe, similar to other Near Eastern storm gods. His consort was Hebat, my mother goddess, queen of heaven, perhaps originally of Syrian origin. And then there's Kumarbi.
Kumarbi, who was he?
Kumarbi was seen as the father of the gods, maybe originally an earth or grain deity. He plays a crucial role in their most famous myth cycle. They had major cult centers for these gods across the Hurrian world.
Right, that mythology. You mentioned it's probably the most influential part of their religion, echoing down through the centuries, especially that epic, the kingship in heaven.
Yes, the Kumarbi cycle. It's a fantastic and rather violent story about divine succession. It starts with a primeval god, Alalu, ruling heaven. He gets overthrown by his cupbearer, Anu, the sky god.
Okay, familiar names there.
Right. Anu then rules, but he gets overthrown by his cupbearer, Kumarbi. And this is where it gets graphic. Kumarbi bites off Anu's genitals and swallows them.
Ouch.
Yeah. As a result, Kumarbi becomes pregnant with Anu's powerful offspring, including the storm god, Teshub. Kumarbi tries to spit Teshub out, but Teshub is eventually born. The rest of the cycle is basically about Kumarbi's relentless attempts to destroy Teshub and reclaim kingship. He fathers these monstrous beings to fight Teshub, most famously the giant stone monster Ulukumi, who grows up from the underworld to challenge the gods. Teshub has to rally the other gods and find a way to defeat Ulukumi to secure his own rule.
And the aha moment here is the connection to later Greek mythology.
Absolutely. The parallels between this Hurrian Kumarbi cycle and the Greek poet Hesiod's Theogony, written centuries later, are undeniable and striking.
How so?
You have the same core themes. A succession of sky gods, a violent castration motif, Ouranos, castrated by Kronos and Hesiod, a usurper god who tries to swallow his offspring, Kronos swallowing his children, and the ultimate triumph of a powerful storm god, Zeus defeating Kronos and the Titans. The structure and specific plot points are just too similar to be coincidental.
So this is clear evidence of Near Eastern myth traveling west.
It's some of the clearest evidence we have. It shows how these complex mythological narratives circulated and were adapted, traveling from the Hurrian world, maybe via Anatolia or Syria, into the Aegean and becoming foundational elements of Greek literature and religion.
Any other unique religious practices?
Well, they seem to have practiced necromancy, communicating with the dead. That unique structure found at Urkesh called the Abi is often interpreted as a sort of pit or installation used for rituals to contact ancestral spirits in the underworld.
Fascinating. What about their material culture? Art? Technology?
They had a reputation as skilled metallurgists. Remember that possible loanword tabira for coppersmith in Sumerian? That points to early expertise. They were also known for glassmaking in the later Bronze Age.
And pottery.
Yeah.
You mentioned Nuzi ware.
Yes, pottery is key archaeologically. Earlier, you have Kabur ware associated with Horian areas, but the real signature pottery of the Mitanni Empire period is Nuzi ware. It's very recognizable. Elegant shapes, often tall goblets or chalices made of fine clay, usually with distinctive white painted geometric or floral patterns, sometimes stylized birds, the famous Nuzi bird on a dark background, either brown or black.
And finding this pottery helps map Mitanni's influence.
Exactly. Its widespread distribution across northern Mesopotamia and Syria is a primary archaeological marker for tracking the reach of Mitannian cultural and political influence during the 15th and 14th centuries BCE.
Okay, now for something you hinted at earlier, which is just, well, amazing. The Hurrians didn't just leave texts and pots. They left us music. Actual written music.
Yes. It's truly remarkable. The Hurrian hymns from Ugarit. We're talking about a collection of about 36 clay tablets dating to around 1400 BCE. They contain Hurrian texts, hymns, but some also include what appears to be musical notation.
Musical notation from 1400 BCE.
Indeed. One tablet in particular, known as H.6, is the most complete. It contains the lyrics for a hymn to Nikkal, who was the goddess of orchards, wife of the moon god, and crucially, below the lyrics, it has instructions for the music. This makes it the oldest substantially complete work of notated music that has survived from anywhere in the world. It predates the next oldest examples by, like, a millennium.
That's incredible. What does the notation tell us? Can we actually hear what Hurrian music sounded like?
Well, that's where the scholarly debate comes in. The notation seems to give instructions for a singer accompanied by a 9-stringed instrument, probably a type of lyre or harp called a semum. It includes terms that seem to refer to specific musical intervals and possibly tuning steps. Interpretations suggest it uses a diatonic scale, similar to our major scale, and describes harmonies or specific ways notes should be played together.
So we're looking at quite sophisticated Bronze Age music theory here.
It certainly appears so. While the precise interpretation is still discussed how exactly to reconstruct the melody and harmony, the notation itself points to a well-developed system for recording music. It offers this tantalizing glimpse into the sounds and musical artistry of the ancient Near East, a truly unique legacy.
So as we start to wrap this up, it's clear that understanding the Hurrians means piecing together clues from many different places. It really is that mosaic you mentioned.
Absolutely. Our knowledge comes from excavations at key sites, each providing a different piece of the puzzle. Urkesh, Telmozon, gave us that early royal title Endan, the Tisha Hall inscription, that unique abbey structure showing us their early kingdom and religious heartland.
Right.
Nuzi, Yorgan Tepe, provided those thousands of tablets detailing everyday life, law, society in a provincial center, and it's the type site for Nuzi ware.
And all of what?
Altare Telechana on the western frontier gave us the statue of Idrimi with its inscription showing the vassal relationship with Mitanni and insights into how Hurrian social structures like the Marianu might have been imposed on local populations. Telbrak, ancient Nagar, was another important early center showing cultural transitions. Each site adds vital context.
And even though their own political power eventually faded, their cultural impact was huge, wasn't it? Especially on the Hittites, the ones who partly conquered them. This Hurrianization.
Yes, the cultural transmission to the Hittites around 1400 BCE and after is profound. Hittite culture, especially religion and mythology, was deeply reshaped by Hurrian influence.
How so?
The Hittite state pantheon became heavily populated with Hurrian deities. Tershu was identified with the Hittite storm god Taruna, Hebat with the sun goddess of Arena, and many others were adopted wholesale. You can see this clearly in the carvings at the Hittite rock sanctuary of Yazilikaya. Many of the gods depicted there are Hurrian, labeled with their Hurrian names.
And they preserved Hurrian myths, too.
Yes, Hittite scribes meticulously translated and copied Hurrian literature, most famously the Kumarbi cycle. They preserved it for us. The Hurrian language itself even gained prestige at the Hittite court. Queens, like the influential Pudupa, had Hurrian names, and the language was used in important state religious rituals.
So even in defeat, their culture achieved a kind of victory.
In a way, yes. It shows the power of cultural influence even when political structures fail.
And the study of Hurrian's Hurritology, it's not a closed book, right? It's still evolving.
Definitely not closed. New discoveries, new analyses of text, they constantly refine our understanding. There's ongoing research in linguistics, pinning down phonology, finding new words, debating whether it was still a widely spoken language late on. New editions of texts from places like Imar and Ugarit add detail. Mythology studies continue to explore those fascinating connections.
And those big questions remain.
Oh, yes. The enduring questions still drive the field. Where exactly was the Hurrian homeland if there was one single origin point? What was the precise nature and extent of that Indo-Aryan influence in Mitanni? And, of course, the big one, where is Washakani? Finding the lost capital of Inhani would be a monumental discovery. Ultimately, the Hurrians are sort of a paradox, aren't they? They were this incredibly creative and influential culture. Their ideas, their language, their myths spread far and wide. Yet their own political structures, especially Mitanni, were relatively transient compared to Egypt or Babylon. For 1,000 years, maybe more, they were this crucial thread woven into the complex tapestry of the ancient Near East. They acted as a conduit, a bridge for ideas, technologies, and stories moving across the region.
That unique language, those powerful myths that reached all the way to Greece, the social customs reflected in Nuzi that maybe shed light on biblical narratives, and, astonishingly, the world's oldest known piece of music. It all points to a really rich, sophisticated civilization. It really makes you wonder, doesn't it? What other lost civilizations or forgotten stories are out there, just waiting for us to patiently piece them back together? Thank you for joining us on this exploration of the Hurrian world. Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep learning.